This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Roy Choi, is a chef who's famous for food that isn't fancy. In fact, by the end of this interview, he may have convinced you to try making ketchup fried rice. He also will be pretty convincing about why you shouldn't try crack or get addicted to gambling, like he did before he became a chef. Choi is partly responsible for the food truck movement. His Korean barbecue tacos, which he sells out of his Kogi food trucks, took off first in L.A., then around the country. Choi was born in South Korea in 1970, but his family moved to L.A. when he was two. When he was a child, his parents owned a Korean restaurant near Anaheim for a few years. Choi has a new book that's part memoir and part cookbook called L.A. Sun, My Life, My City, My Food. He spoke with Terry last Thursday.
Roy Choi, welcome to Fresh Air. Your tacos with Korean barbecue, which you've become famous for.
Everyone wants to start there.
Yeah. Had you tasted anything like that before starting to make it? I mean, I know you've made all kinds of unusual dishes in your time, but specifically that?
No, the Korean taco, it was a phenomenon. It was, you know, it just came out of us. We didn't really think about it. So the flavor, in a way, didn't exist before, but it was a mashup of everything we had gone through in our life.
What makes it work flavor-wise?
If we're talking specifically, I would say the lime juice, the garlic, and the soy sauce, like that combination right there is an elixir that created like this crazy flow, you know. But more than that, I think it became a voice for a certain part of Los Angeles and a certain part of immigration and a certain part of life that wasn't really out there in the universe. We all knew it and we all grew up with it, but the taco kind of pulled it together. And then when you ate it, it all of a sudden made sense, you know.
So when you were growing up, did you have a lot of Mexican friends? Like, was there any kind of connection or animosity between young people in the Korean-American and Mexican-American communities of L.A.?
No, not at all. I mean, I grew up around so many different people in so many different neighborhoods, but the Latino heritage and neighborhoods and people have always been a part of my life ever since I was a kid. And I was even a lowrider when I was 16, 17. Up until I was 18, I rolled with a crew from Norwalk, and I think I was the only Asian dude, one of the only Asian dudes around that was rolling in a drop-down, deep-dish rim, you know, blazer. And so I've always been around it. I've been in kitchens for a very, very long time. We're kind of like similar kindred spirits in a way where we just kind of, you know, work hard, family, do our thing, you know.
So speaking of the, you know, Korean barbecue taco, what makes barbecue Korean barbecue?
It's very different than American barbecue. American barbecue is all slow and low, you know, or low and slow, as they say down in the South in Texas. But Korean barbecue is thinner cuts of meat. So instead of taking whole briskets and whole sides of meat and smoking them and letting them go for a long time, Korean barbecue is thin cuts of meat and marinated and then grilled quickly over charcoal and mesquite. And really quickly, almost like flashed. And then you just eat that with rice and different vegetables and pickles and kimchi. So in a sense, it's like, you know, I don't even know if the word barbecue applies. It's the English word that was applied to it, but it's in a way, it's not really barbecue. It's grilling, you know, it's like just searing and charring.
So you want to give us your recipe for the taco itself?
Yeah, the taco itself is really, as I was putting it together, it was all the pieces of my life started to come together. It was almost like an avalanche. And so it was growing up, it was being around low riding, it was being around growing up in Korea, the immigration, being around the American school system, all the snack food and junk food that I've eaten, all the tacos that I've eaten, so it was all these things. And then so I really wanted to make it feel like Los Angeles. So I felt like it had to be just like a street taco in L.A. So it was on a 4-inch tortilla, two tortillas, griddled really nicely. And then the meat wanted to do Korean barbecue, but then I was thinking carne asada. So it was like this feeling that I wanted the meat to be cooked, then chopped, like it's been chopped all day, and then thrown back on the plancha so it gets crispy again. And then I thought of that feeling you get. It was like trying to capture everything in one bite. So that feeling you get right before you eat Korean barbecue, you get a little salad. So I was thinking of that salad and if I could put that in there. And then cilantro and onion, which come on true Mexican tacos. And then a salsa roja. But then the salsa roja, we would combine the dry chili arbol and the smoke flavors and the roasted garlic, but then also with Korean chili paste, lime juice, and soy sauce. And then all that just came together, just whirled together. And then sesame seeds on top. And then in the slaw, it has green onions, cabbage, and romaine lettuce. So it's like this whole meal in one bite.
Wow. Yeah. Sounds really interesting. Sounds good. So how much time do you actually spend on trucks?
I'm there every day.
Assumed that you had other people doing that.
No, I have a crew, you know, that cooks, just like a chef has cooks in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But the trucks are my kitchen, you know, and so that's where I am. You know, if I'm not doing something crazy like this, you know, talking to you or like, you know, doing a book tour or whatever, like I'm with my trucks on the streets with the people. I don't know where else I would be. It's my life. Just like you do radio every morning, you know, like this is what you do. This is what I do.
But you have several restaurants now, too.
Yeah. Every day I wake up, my only goal every day when I wake up is to try to see every single person within my organizations and shake their hand and give them a hug and then check the food and then go back through at night. So my route is usually I have four restaurants, so I hit all the restaurants during the day, check on prep, say hello to everybody, hit one lunch truck, hit the trucks in the morning as well to check on prep, and then do some office work. I don't really do that much office work. I just go to the office, and I'm like Steve Carell in the office. You know, like I just go around, and like I don't know what I do in the office. I look at paperwork and act like I'm understanding what's going on there, and I shake my head and put my hand on my chin and like, But then I take off, and then I go back out and check on the trucks again, and then I go back out to the restaurants and then enjoy the crowd and enjoy the people and see them eating. I really get a lot of energy in my information from how people are eating the food, so that's where I am.
So you were born in Korea. Your mother's from North Korea, your father from South Korea. They had actually both emigrated to the U.S., met in the U.S., but then ended up moving back to Korea, where you were born in 1970, and then you all moved back when you were two. So when you were a baby, you were in South Korea, and you're right that there was no baby food there, no baby food per se. And I thought, well, I can understand that there's no like commercially prepared baby food in jars. But it also meant that you were getting fed pretty adult food when you were really, really young. So how do you think that affected your palate? Like, what were some of the things you were fed as a baby there that a baby wouldn't get fed here? And how did that affect what you consider to be, you know, like your comfort food?
Bean sprouts, roots, tubers, herbs, kimchi, pickles, rice, fermented paste, soups, braises, stews, pureed mung bean pancakes and seafood and octopus and, you know, all those things, eating it from a very young age, I don't know, it's like being exposed to just amazing jazz, you know, since from being a baby, you know, like just you look, everything about what you experience from a young age influences who you are, I think, you know. So like for me with the food, it started my life running instead of crawling, you know.
So then you moved to LA when you're two. Your parents eventually open a Korean restaurant. Some of the food there is prepared by your mother, who you say was already kind of famous in the neighborhood for her kimchi. What was so great about her kimchi? And in doing this, for anybody who hasn't tasted kimchi, you should describe it.
Okay. Well, you know, it's more than just her kimchi. The thing about immigrant communities, wherever country you're from, we have we have whole other lives that, that aren't documented in English, you know, like we have whole other, we, you know, we have our American life, but we have our whole other life and communities and friends and networks and families. So it's almost like you have, you can like have your work life or your regular life and then also have this whole other existence. And so within our Korean network and our Korean community life, my mom's kimchi was crazy because like she would make it at parties and feed everyone and everyone would, they would be crawling over each other to get to it, you know, like it would be gone in a second. And then so, you know, we started selling it and like packing it and bringing it to homes as gifts. And it was like selling mixtapes, you know, she would have our trunk full of stuff, you know. And so I think, you know, my mom, she had flavor in her fingertips, you know. She had this connection and this innate ability to capture flavor in the moment, and people felt it, you know. And once your food, because our lives were so based around food, when someone is good at food, it's everyone notices, you know, and it's a big deal. And kimchi itself is it's like sauerkraut. You could think of it like sauerkraut. It's fermented cabbage or fermented vegetables with chili powder. And usually, some type of seafood agent, which acts as kind of a kickstarter to the fermentation, and then you marinate or you salt it, then you marinate it, and then you pack it, and then in the olden days, even now, but in the olden days, you pack it underground, and then you take it out after it ferments, and it's really taking the bounty of all the vegetables at the harvest. And then pickling them. So it's kind of, if you consider like in America, it's like jamming, you know, like making jams and stuff, you know, and or preserves. You preserve everything and then go through the cold winter.
So your parents get very prosperous. They become millionaires. You move to, you know, a very swank and very white neighborhood. And you're in seventh grade at about that time. And right at that point, I was doomed. So why did you feel doomed just as your parents had kind of like arrived in terms of prosperity?
I was doomed because everyone had peroxide in their hair and they were coming from ski trips in Mammoth Mountain and like snorkeling trips in the Cayman Islands and listening to like Depeche Mode and The Cure. And I had never seen anything like that before, and it wasn't really my rhythm, and I did the best I could. And so, like, I was doomed because, like, you know, there weren't that many Asians, and, you know, the girls weren't really, like, feeling me. And I was also doomed because, like, the food, if we get down to the food itself was different for me, too, because, like, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed at the time to show a lot of the food that I was going through because everywhere I went, it was so different, you know, and I being young, you know, like youngsters are mean to each other sometimes. So I bring friends over and they look at my food and be like, oh, what is that? You know, and so.
What's an example of embarrassing food back then?
Fish heads, bubbling fermented paste, pig intestines, fish roe, fish guts, squid, marinated anchovies, drying pollock and croaker in baskets all along your front yard, you know.
You know, I can definitely see how that would be different from what,
yeah, it's different,
what your neighbors, you know, were doing and eating.
Yeah, when you bring a bunch of, you know, rich friends from Orange County over to your house and your whole house is surrounded by dead salted fish.
excuse me.
it was tough, you know. I was young, and you know, but I loved it at the time. You know, when I say the word embarrassed, it's not that I was embarrassed and tried to shy away from it, or that I tried to put it into the dirt and like hope it never came out again. It was just I didn't have the language to really stick up for it at that time, you know. So I went deep into addiction and just like went into a dark way.
So you mentioned after you moved to this like affluent neighborhood and you feel really out of place, not fitting in, you end up getting addictions. I mean, first an addiction to crack, and then an addiction to gambling.
That was my addiction. Was gambling was, you know, crack was just, it was a fling. And then gambling hit me at like 22, 21, around there. It was like just like 3 years of the darkest time of my life. But it started out just all fireworks and pom-poms, you know what I mean? Like, it was an amazing ride for the first year. I mean, just tens of thousands of dollars in shoeboxes, just kisses and massages and meals everywhere and nightclubs and just balling crazy. And then I started losing. You know, the truth is it's about this metaphysical luck, you know. And if you ride that dragon's tail and you're dripping with that confidence, you can just ride it and ride it, and it just like it continues to mushroom. But then once you start chasing it, it just sucks you all the way in. And I started chasing it, and it's like, as long as it's like money. It's like all money. As long as it takes you to build it, you lose it 100 times faster.
So after getting to a low point in terms of being addicted to gambling, being deep in debt, you decide...
I owed people money. Mm-hmm. I lost all my friends, lost all my family, stole from my family, stole from myself, sold everything I had.
Wow.
It was crazy, yeah.
And then you decided you wanted to cook. Like, what was the turning point?
I was there, you know, wherever that is, on the bottom of whatever ocean that is. I was watching TV in the morning. It was 1995, maybe 96, around there. And I saw Emeril Lagasse on his first show, The Essence of Emeril. And I was watching it in a haze. And
it was a cooking show.
It was a cooking show. It was Emeril's first show. It's called The Essence of Emeril. It's just him in like a black and white checkerboard kitchen with just a camera and him, and he was looking at the camera and cooking, and it was very personal. It was almost like he was right there with you. And I was watching that in the haze, and I felt like he was talking to me. And it was a sledgehammer on my head, and I was like, this is it, you know, this is what I gotta do. And enrolled in a night class in LA, and I was like, okay, let's do this.
When you ended up going to the Culinary Institute of America.
Yeah.
Tell me something that you learned at the Culinary Institute of America that just changed your thinking about food.
You know, the Culinary Institute of America, for me, the thing that really dialed it in was the structure of the program. You know, like, I have a, you know, very short attention span. You know, I'm very compulsive, and I live things out. I live whole lifetimes out in days, you know, and so like I'm done with stuff a lot, and then I move on. But this didn't allow me that wiggle room. You know, if you give me wiggle room, you know, I'll wiggle right out of your life. You know, so like, but the structure of the CIA didn't allow me any wiggle room, and that was the most important thing I needed at that life. You know, because it's not like a traditional schooling, like college system, where you have the whole semester and then you can goof around and they just take the midterm, whatever. They're block programs, so they're specific 7-day, 14-day, and 21-day block programs. And if you miss a day, it's like missing a month. And so that was really, really important for me.
Let's pause here for a recipe.
Okay.
And this is not a recipe. I'm sure this is not a recipe you were taught at the Culinary Institute of America, but it's in your new book, L.A. Sun, My Life, My City, My Food. And I'm going to preface this question, actually, by telling you one of the top five worst meals I was ever served as a child was spaghetti with ketchup. I mean, it was like spaghetti from the box with cold ketchup on top.
Well, maybe this recipe can, you know, I've confronted a lot of my skeletons. Maybe this recipe will let you confront this skeleton.
Heal me.
I will heal you with this, you know, because it's not cold ketchup on top of noodles. It's treating the ketchup like tomato paste in a veal stock or in a brown espagnole sauce. You know, It's getting the smoky flavor out of the tomato. So, but it's in a, it's in a L.A. kind of like drug state, you know, like no money, kind of like just a homie way of looking at it way, you know. So it's like blending all the worlds together. And it, and it's also like a snack food within the Korean community of, you know, like when we, like when you, when a lot of people throw like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich together, like we make ketchup fried rice, you know. So really the recipe is very, very simple. It's, you could literally do it with just ketchup and rice. But in the recipe we have, we added minced scallions, minced carrot, minced garlic, minced kimchi, and then ketchup, and then sesame seeds, and then one egg. So you could omit all the vegetables, but why would you? So the thing is, you just saute the vegetables and get the aroma, and then you add the ketchup, and you kind of like pull the flavor out of it and get it smoky, add the day-old rice, and then make a fried rice with it, and then you cook an egg, and then a sunny-side-up egg, and put it on top and with sesame seeds, and then you mix that all together. It's really, really delicious. It's munchy food.
I could see that being good.
Can I just ask, how much ketchup do you use?
Okay, so this recipe, I have 3 tablespoons of ketchup for 2 cups of rice. And there's like a tablespoon of each of the vegetables. So it's like, this is for about like 1.5, 2 people. Oh, no, actually it serves 4 to 6. I was thinking, I'm kind of hungry. Sorry. if you're hungry, it serves 1 to 2 people. If you're not hungry, it serves 4 to 6.
Yeah. Well, this sounds great. It's not making me feel any better about the spaghetti with ketchup out of the bottle, cold ketchup out of the bottle, pour it on top.
Yeah. But that's the scar that you have. I can't correct that, you know. But maybe this can just kind of ease it for you.
Yeah. So one more question. You know, your mother had been famous when you were a child in the neighborhood for her cooking. And now you're kind of famous in the whole country for yours. She's still alive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So who is considered the better cook in the family now?
Oh, man. I can't talk smack about my mom's cooking, man. Like, even if I was better than her, like, I still got to say her, you know? Like, I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm not gonna, like, challenge her on Iron Chef or nothing like that. So, it's hard. I'll tell you the truth, though. It's hard for me and my mom to cook together because we're such, like, aggressive personalities when it comes to food. Mm-hmm. Like we are toxic when it comes to us cooking together in the kitchen. So if she's cooking, I'm like on the couch watching TV. I won't even go near the kitchen. And if I'm cooking, I'm like, yo, you know, like I put a force field around the kitchen. I'm like, Mom, out. Nope. You know, and so we're real toxic as far as that goes. So, but I mean, she raised me. She cooked the food that I grew up on, so I could never beat her.
Roy Choi, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Roy Choi spoke with Terry Gross last Thursday. His new memoir is called L.A. Sun, My Life, My City, My Food. You'll find his recipe for ketchup fried rice on our website, freshair.npr.org. Italian writer Elena Ferrante has been called by The Economist the best contemporary novelist you've never heard of. Since 2005, all 6 of her novels have been translated into English. The most recent of these is The Story of a New Name, the 2nd volume of a trilogy about the life stories of 2 young girls who grew up poor in Naples dreaming of something more. Our critic at large, John Powers, says that it's fascinating both in itself and for what it reveals about a writer so fiercely good, John has been known to force copies of her books into the hands of his friends.
Some writers you read and move on. But every now and then you read one whose work knocks you back against the wall. This happened to me with the great Italian novelist Elena Ferrante. I first encountered her through her scalding 2002 novel, The Days of Abandonment, whose narrator, Olga, may be the scariest jilted wife since Medea. What makes Olga scary is not what she does, but what she thinks and feels, and her ferocious precision in describing everything from lousy sexual encounters to her not altogether maternal feelings about her children. Hooked, I quickly devoured Ferrante's other available novels, Troubling Love and The Lost Daughter. They too spoke with such personal directness, I felt sure they must be confessional. Yet when I tried to confirm this, I soon discovered that Elena Ferrante is a pen name, and that she's as publicity-shy as J.D. Salinger, leading some male commentators in Italy to claim, predictably enough, that she's actually a man. Me, I was left wondering how Ferrante came to write with such fearless power. Then, 2 years ago, an indirect answer proposed itself. She brought out My Brilliant Friend, the first volume of a trilogy known as the Neapolitan novels. Narrated by a 60-something writer named Elena, the book feels like Ferrante's personal origin myth, her portrait of the artist as a young woman. This seems even clearer in Volume 2, The Story of a New Name, just out in a keen English version by Ferrante's regular translator, Anne Goldstein. The Neapolitan novels tell the story of Elena Greco and Lila Cerullo, who meet at age 8 in early 1950s Naples. They bond over their love of books, and their yearning for a life larger than what's offered by their poor working-class neighborhood that cruelly grinds down everyone, especially women. Where Elena is a bright, accommodating girl eager for approval, she's a classic A student, her brilliant friend Lila is more gifted, sexier, and utterly implacable. She does what she wants. In a decision that alters their lives, Elena's parents pay to let her continue beyond grade school, but Lila's father refuses. As the story of A New Name begins, the ripples of this decision couldn't be more obvious. Even as Elena goes to high school and pines for a handsome upperclassman, the gorgeous Lila is getting married at 16 to Stefano, a local grocer who buys her clothes like Jackie Kennedy's, but whom she holds in contempt. Over the course of the novel, we watch their destinies diverge. Elena is thwarted in love and feels intimidated when she starts mingling with the educated classes at college in Pisa. Lila's trapped in a vulgar gilded cage, whose bars she shakes until her husband beats her. As ever, Elena feels overshadowed by Lila, whose life always seems more incandescent than her own, while Lila envies Elena's shot at escaping their old neighborhood's small-mindedness and machismo. While Ferrante's first three novels are remarkable for their compression and intensity, The Days of Abandonment remains her masterpiece, My Brilliant Friend and The Story of a New Name leaven her fierceness with a new warmth and expansiveness. They don't merely offer a teeming vision of working-class Naples with its cobblers and professores, communists and mobbed-up businessmen, womanizing poets and downtrodden wives. They present one of modern fiction's richest portraits of a friendship. It's tempting to say women's friendship, because Ferrante follows Elena's and Lila's search for freedom in a culture so male-dominated that 50 years later, Silvio Berlusconi could hold bunga-bunga sex parties and still keep getting elected prime minister. Never one to fear dark or spiky emotions, Ferrante captures their shifting friendship in all its jagged complicity and competition, its furious jealousies and lasting affections. For all of Lila's defiant grandeur, these books are finally about Elena. To find her own original voice, she must shake off the crushing values she was raised with, resist the blandishments of conventional success, and learn from Lila without being overpowered by her. To achieve all this is an arduous struggle. But then again, that's no big surprise. As her novels make painfully clear, you don't get to write as brilliantly as Elena Ferrante for free. You have to earn it.
John Powers writes about film and television for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed The Story of a New Name by Elena Ferrante. Coming up, the history of the industrial musical. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
My bathroom is a private kind of place.
Why would someone write a sentimental ballad about a bathroom? For the same reason, someone would write a rousing song about tractors, so the song could be used in an industrial musical. These musicals were like Broadway shows, but were written and performed for corporate sales meetings and conventions. The lyrics were all about the products being sold and how to sell them. Some of these industrial musicals were lavish and costly, even though they would be performed only once. And as ridiculous as the songs were, they often were written and performed by really talented people. A few had lyrics by the young Sheldon Harnick, who later became famous for writing the lyrics for the Broadway hits Fiddler on the Roof, She Loves Me, and Fiorello. Last Tuesday, Terry spoke with Sheldon Harnick and with Steve Young, author of the new book, Everything's Coming Up Prophets, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. Young is a writer for The Late Show with David Letterman. Before we hear their conversation, let's hear a little more of My Bathroom.
My bathroom. Special room where I primp and fuss and groom, where I can get away from all and really feel in bloom. I'm free.
Okay, I love that song. Steve Young, Sheldon Harnick, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. Steve, you wrote the book, Everything's Coming Up Prophets. Where is this song from?
This is from a 1969 American Standard convention show in Las Vegas, and it was for the distributors of all the American Standard bathroom fixtures. Many of the songs on the record are filled with details about the new line of shower stalls and tubs, but this was really more of an anthem, an ode to the business as a whole, why they do what they do. And it's a remarkable piece of work that I've been humming around the house for 20 years, and everybody who hears it is just floored by it.
I love the subtext of this, is because the subtext is like, this poor woman has no privacy at home. Her family is driving her crazy, so she has to lock herself in the bathroom to find any peace. Sheldon Harnick, you are such a brilliant lyricist. Thank you for coming. What do you think of the lyric, To My Bathroom?
Oh, it's a very professional, romantic ballad about a bathroom, so that I could help but chuckle all the way through it. But it's extremely well done. I would quibble with one rhyme. I think it was the writer was a little stuck for rhymes for room, so he said, I'm in a bloom or something like that,
yes.
Which I thought was a rather weakly. But aside from that, it's a very professional job.
What's the history of these musicals? Where did they start?
These are musicals, often full Broadway-style musicals, that were written for company conventions and sales meetings. They were never for the public to hear. They were only to educate and entertain and motivate the sales force, so they would leave the business meeting going out revved up to sell more bathtubs or typewriters or tractors or insurance plans or what have you.
And so did a lot of companies do these?
Yes. I don't know the exact number because we've never really had a full picture of how many shows were done. The souvenir records that I've been collecting are clearly the tiny minority of shows that were done, but I would say hundreds of companies were doing them over a period of decades.
How did you even get interested in these?
It goes back about 20 years. I've been a writer for The Letterman Show since the early 90s, and when I got to the show, I was asked if I could head up the old Dave's Record Collection segment, in which on the show, Dave would hold up strange, unintentionally funny records. We'd hear a little clip. Dave would have a joke. We'd all go home heroes. I was the one finding the strange records. And in these days when there were still used record stores in the city, I would come home with, you know, William Shatner is singing or Hear How to Touch type. But I also started finding these very odd corporate artifacts that I didn't really understand at first, but I would find myself singing these songs to myself days or weeks later and thinking, why is this song about diesel engines so catchy? Why am I still wandering around singing about my insurance man? And it was because they were fabulously well done in many cases. And it was a hidden part of the entertainment world, but huge budgets, professionals doing their best work oftentimes. And I just decided I had to find out about this for myself. I began collecting and going to record shows, calling record dealers, and I was off and running.
Well, Sheldon Harnick, you are so well known and loved for your musicals, including Fiddler on the Roof and She Loves Me and Fiorello. How did you end up writing lyrics with your partner, your late partner, Jerry Bock, for industrial musicals?
Well, I only did one industrial with Jerry. That was for the Ford Motor Company. I started writing lyrics out of desperation. I was broke and wondering where my next job, my next meal was coming from, although I had had several successful review songs on Broadway. And then I got a phone call from an advertising agency. They did industrials. They helped write them. They produced them. And it turned out that they were doing a new industrial. I think it was for the Shell Gasoline Company. And they knew my review songs. So I got a call to do an industrial. I had no idea what that was. And I said, how do I find out what I'm doing? And they referred me to their musical director, the wonderful musical director named John Morris, who later wrote several scores for the Mel Brooks movies. Anyway, I went over to John's. He gave me a tutorial and told me how to write an industrial. And so I did the first one for Shell Gas, which was, thank God, successful. We had, at that time, they did not use original music, or at least not the ones that I worked for. The theory was that the salesmen who were attending these conferences, they'd have enough work just to hear the lyric and absorb that without having to absorb new music, too. So I was told I could use whatever music I wanted to, which was great fun. I used my favorite show tunes. And then a couple years later, I found out somebody had done an industrial and used Meredith Willson's Trouble from
The Music Man.
And somebody in the show was a friend of Meredith Willson's and wrote to him saying, Meredith, you would have been delighted to hear this new lyric to Trouble. Well, Meredith Willson was not delighted. He sued. And after that, any industrial I did, the music had to be original because they were just breaking the law by setting new lyrics to all these tunes. So at any rate, I did write about, I don't know, four or five industrials. And then Jerry and I got the chance to do this huge industrial for the Ford Tractor Company.
I want to play a song from it, and this is called Golden Harvest. Sheldon Harnick, do you actually remember this song? Because if not, hearing it will perhaps bring back memories.
I don't remember, and I'm looking forward to
hearing
it.
Oh, I can't wait to hear what you think of it. Okay, so this is Golden Harvest, a song from an industrial musical for the Ford Tractor Company.
A golden harvest in 1959. Gonna be a lot more buyers to sign the dotted line with the new Ford tractors. The future's looking fine. Now's the time to roll your sleeves up, 'cause if you rise and shine, gonna be a golden harvest in 1959. Gonna be a lot more business. Oh yes indeed. Wait till everybody hears you've got exactly what they need. Just like Jack and the Beanstalk, you've got a magic seed. Now's the time to roll your sleeves up, go out and take the lead. Gonna be a golden harvest with Selectocene. Turn your tractors and implements to a bumper crop of dollars and cents. Gonna be a golden harvest in 1959. Gonna be a lot more.
Okay, Sheldon Harnick, now that you've heard your 1959 song Golden Harvest from an industrial for Ford Tractors, what do you think?
I miss Jerry Bock. I think the music was exciting and just right. And I just remembered, at least in the shows I did not have a totally free hand to create lyrics. They gave me things to say. They gave me slogans. They gave me information that they wanted in the song. And listening to that song, I I was thinking, gee, I did a nice professional job. And in the first section, there must be about five or six rhymes for shine. And that's well done. And I love what Jerry did, some of those yump-ba-dum-ba-dum-bum-ba-dum-ba-dum, those rhythms. They're very catchy. It's a good song.
Sheldon, I have to congratulate you on the rhyme of implements and dollars and cents. It's one of the examples of the kind of rhyme that really appealed to me when I started collecting this.
Could we pay tribute with the whole line, turn your tractors and implements to a bumper crop of dollars and cents? That is so
that's
great.
Right. That's what you don't get anywhere else but in these shows, is that sort of unexpected combination.
And Steve Young, what was the point of spending so much money on these industrial shows?
There was the belief for quite a long time. I don't know if there was ever hard data to back it up, but if you bring everyone together for this thrilling theatrical experience, and it often actually was thrilling to the audience, then they would have a renewed sense of purpose. They would get out there. They would charge ahead and have renewed energy for selling. And many of the songs were packed with information about details of the new products or the marketing strategies that were being presented. So you'd go home, ideally, all fired up with a new sense of your pride in working for the company and a way forward for what you were going to do as a salesperson.
There's a song that you write about in your book. When I hear this one, honestly, it almost brings me to tears. It's like a woman singing about her husband and about how her one man is no longer a one man operation.
Oh, yes.
Anymore.
From Diesel Dazzle.
Yeah, tell us about this show.
A fabulous title, which really does combine the two worlds colliding in one phrase, heavy industry and the dazzle of show business. Detroit Diesel Engine Division of General Motors, 1966, composed by Hank Beebe, a wonderful composer, still up in Portland, Maine, hard at work on new music. His late partner, Bill Heyer, was the lyricist, played in Detroit at an auditorium for the Detroit Diesel sales force in spring of 66, and just a knockout piece of work.
So this is about the importance of expanding your shop, is that it?
Yeah, it was about understanding the trials and tribulations of the guy who's running the franchise to rebuild and sell diesel engines, but through the perspective of the put-upon wife. You see this quite often in shows. Sometimes wives came to these shows, and it was nice if you could put in a song about, we know what you go through with your husband working very hard. So it was the overworked husband as seen through the wife's perspective.
And a song that just fits so oddly into the genre of songs about women singing about their man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is One Man Operation from the 1966 show Diesel Dazzle.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go.
He's coming home again, just like other men. At supper, he'll walk through that door. For the one man in my life is no one man operation anymore. He knows what hard work is, and its rewards were his, till work became a weary chore. But now the one man in my life is no one man operation anymore. Once he thought he could do it, but as more business came, rebuilding, selling, taking orders too. Work days, holidays, they all became the same, and it was night when his day was through. He did it all alone, keep books and tend the phone, 18 hours every 24. But now the one man in my life is no one man operation anymore. Now he has two mechanics, a parts and service man, a girl to take the calls and keep the books. He spends weekends giving the children all he can and telling me how young his wife looks.
I have to say, you know, I listen to that song and I kind of laugh and cry at the same time because it's really hysterical, but it's actually so well written. it's very moving. I kind of tear up when the...
And beautifully sung.
Yes, and beautifully sung.
About a parts and service man or rebuilding that collides with that kind of music and that kind of performance. That's what really knocked me out when I first started finding these records was the crazy juxtaposition of the subject matter and the execution. I just could not believe it was real, and it is real.
Sheldon Harnick, Steve Young, it's just been great to talk with you. I really appreciate your time, and just thanks.
Very welcome.
Thank you, Terry.
Steve Young is the author of the book Everything's Coming Up Profits. Sheldon Harnick wrote songs for a few industrials before becoming famous for Fiddler on the Roof and Fiorello. They spoke with Terry last Tuesday. You can hear the full interview, which included singer John Russell, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also hear some of the recordings we played.
The work of the world is never done. It never lessens, shrinks, or diminishes.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced for corporate sales meetings and conventions. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
More power to you, with the power master, the work master, and the power major too.